This is Audible. Stasiland. Stories from Behind the Berlin Wall. By Anna Funder. Read by Danica Fairman. About the author. Anna Funder was born in Melbourne in 1966 and grew up there and in Paris. She has worked as an international lawyer and a radio and television producer. In 1997, she was writer-in-residence at the Australia Centre in Potsdam. Stasiland, which was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award 2003 and in Australia for the Age Book of the Year and the Queensland Premier's Literary Awards for non-fiction, is her first book. Dedication for Craig Ulchin. Quotations. A silent, crazy jungle under glass. The member of the wedding, Carson McCullers. The two of you, violator and victim, collaborator, violin, are linked, forever perhaps, by the obscenity of what has been revealed to you, by the sad knowledge of what people are capable of. We are all guilty. The True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist, Brayton Breitenbach.
Let the jury consider their verdict, the king said for about the 20th time that day.
No, no, said the queen. Sentence first, verdict afterwards.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll. Chapter 1. Berlin. Winter 1996. I am hungover and steer myself like a car through the crowds at Alexanderplatz station. Several times I miscalculate my width, scraping into a bin and an advertising bollard. Tomorrow bruises will develop on my skin, like a picture from a negative. A man turns from the wall, smiling and zipping up his fly. He is missing shoelaces and some teeth. His face and his shoes are as loose as each other. Another man in overalls, with a broom the size of a tennis court sweeper, pushes disinfectant pellets along the platform. He makes arcs of green powder and cigarette butts and urine. A morning drunk walks on the ground like it might not hold him. I'm catching the underground to Ostbahnhof to board the regional line down to Leipzig, a couple of hours from here. I sit on a green bench. I look at green tiles, breathe green air. Suddenly, I don't feel too good. I need to get to the surface quickly and make my way back up the stairs. At ground level, Alexanderplatz is a monstrous expanse of grey concrete designed to make people feel small. It works. It's snowing outside. I move through the slush to where I know there are toilets. Like the train lines, these too are cut into the ground, but no one thought to connect them to the station they serve. As I go down the steps, the sick smell of antiseptic is overpowering. A large woman in a purple apron and loud makeup stands at the bottom. She is leaning on a glass-paned counter, guarding her stash of condoms and tissues and tampons. This is clearly a woman unafraid of the detritus of life. She has shiny, smooth skin and many soft chins. She must be 65. Good morning, I say. I feel awkward. I've heard stories of German babies having their input in food and their output in feces weighed in some attempt to get the measure of life. I've always found this kind of motherly audience inappropriate. I use the toilet and come out and put a coin in her dish. It occurs to me that the purpose of disinfectant globules is to mask the smells of human bodies with something worse.
"What's it like up there?"
the toilet madame asks, nodding at the top of the steps. "Pretty cold." I adjust my little pack. "But not too bad. Not too much black ice."
"This is nothing yet," she sniffs.
I don't know if it's a threat or a boast. This is what they call Berliner Schnauzer, snout. It's attitude. It's in your face. I don't want to stay here, but
but I don't want to go up into the cold either. The disinfectant smell is so strong I can't tell whether I'm feeling sicker or better.
I've been here 21 years, since the winter of 75. I've seen much worse than this.
That's a long time.
Sure is. I have my regulars, I can tell you. They know me, I know them. I had a prince once. A von Hohenzollern.
I think she must use the prince on everyone, but it works. I'm curious. Uh-huh. Before or after the wall came down?
Before. He was over on a day trip from the West. I used to get quite a few Westerners, you know. He invited me,
she pats her large bosom with a flat hand,
to his palace. But of course I couldn't go.
Of course she couldn't go. The Berlin Wall ran a couple of kilometers from here, and there was no getting over it. Along with the Great Wall of China, it was one of the longest structures ever built to keep people separate from one another. She is losing credibility fast, but her story is becoming correspondingly better. And suddenly, I can't smell a thing anymore. Have you travelled yourself since the wall came down? I ask. She throws her head back. I see she is wearing purple eyeliner, which, at that angle, phosphoresces.
Not yet, but I'd like to. Bali, something like that. Or China. Yes, China.
She wraps her painted nails on the glass cabinet and dreams into the middle distance over my left shoulder.
You know what I'd really like to do? I'd really like to have me a look at that wall of theirs.
From Ostbahnhof, the train pulls out and finds its cruising speed. The rhythm soothes like a cradle, hushing my tapping fingers. The conductor's voice comes through speakers reciting our stops.
Wannsee, Bitterfeld, Lutherstadt Wittenberg.
In northern Germany I inhabit the grey end of the spectrum. Grey buildings, grey earth, grey birds, grey trees. Outside, the city and then the country spool past in black and white. Last night is a smoky blur. Another session at the pub with Klaus and his friends. But this is not one of those hangovers where you write the day off to darkness. It is the more interesting kind, where destroyed synapses are reconstructing themselves, sometimes missing their old paths and making odd new connections. I remember things I haven't remembered before, things that do not come out of the ordered store of memories I call my past. I remember my mother's moustache in the sun. I remember the acute hunger and loss feeling of adolescence. I remember the burnt chalk smell of tram brakes in summer. You think you have your past filed away under subject headings, but somewhere it waits to reconnect itself. I remember learning German. So beautiful, so strange. At school in Australia, on the other side of the earth. My family was nonplussed about me learning such an odd, ugly language, and though, of course, too sophisticated to say it, the language of the enemy. But I liked the stickle-brick nature of it, building long, supple words by putting short ones together. Things could be brought into being that had no name in English. Weltanschauung, Schadenfreude, Sippenhaft, Sonderweg, Scheißfreundlichkeit, Vergangenheitsbewältigung. I like the sweeping range of words from heartfelt to heartsick, and I like the order, the directness that I imagined in the people. Then, in the 1980s, I came to live in West Berlin for a while, and I wondered long and hard what went on behind that wall. A barrel-stomached woman opposite me unwraps black bread sandwiches. So far, she has managed to pretend I am not here, although if we weren't careful, our knees could touch. She has painted on her eyebrows in arches of surprise or menace. I think about the feeling I've developed for the former German Democratic Republic. It is a country which no longer exists, but here I am on a train, hurtling through it, its tumble-down houses and bewildered people. This feeling needs a stickle-brick word. I can only describe it as horror romance. It's a dumb feeling, but I don't want to shake it. The romance comes from the dream of a better world that the German communists wanted to build out of the ashes of their Nazi past, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. The horror comes from what they did in its name. East Germany has disappeared, but its remains are still at the site. My travelling companion takes out a packet of West cigarettes, which seem to be the most popular brand here since the wall fell. She lights up and directs her breath of smoke over my head. When she's finished, she butts out in the flip-top bin, clasps her hands around her middle, and falls asleep. Her expression, fixed with pencil, doesn't change. I first visited Leipzig in 1994, nearly 5 years after the wall fell in November 1989. East Germany still felt like a secret walled-in garden, a place lost in time. It wouldn't have surprised me if things had tasted different here, apples like pears, say, or wine like blood. Leipzig was the hub of what everyone now calls Die Wende, the turning point. The Wende was the peaceful revolution against the communist dictatorship in East Germany, the only successful revolution in German history. Leipzig was the start and the heart of it. Now, 2 years later, I'm on my way back. In 1994, I found a town built by accretion. The streets wound crookedly. There were crumbly passages through buildings that led unexpectedly into the next block, and low arches funneled people into underground bars. My map bore no resemblance to how life was lived in Leipzig. People in the know could take hidden shortcuts through buildings, or walk along unmarked lanes between each block, moving above and below ground. I got thoroughly lost. I was looking for the Stasi Museum in the Runde Ecke, or Round Corner Building, which had formerly been the Stasi offices. I needed to see for myself part of the vast apparatus that had been the East German Ministry for State Security. The Stasi was the internal army by which the government kept control. Its job was to know everything about everyone, using any means it chose. It knew who your visitors were. It knew whom you telephoned. It knew if your wife slept around. It was a bureaucracy metastasized through East German society. Overt or covert, there was someone reporting to the Stasi on their fellows and friends in every school, every factory, every apartment block, every pub. Obsessed with detail, the Stasi entirely failed to predict the end of communism, and with it, the end of the country. Between 1989 and 1990, it was turned inside out. Stalinist spy unit one day, museum the next. In its 40 years, the firm generated the equivalent of all records in German history since the Middle Ages. Laid out upright and end to end, the files the Stasi kept on their countrymen and women would form a line 180 kilometers long. Eventually, I found the Runde Ecke, and it was huge. A set of steps led up to vast metal-clad double doors with studs on them. I shrank like Alice. To the right there was a pale rectangle in a cement facade, a bit of the building that hadn't been tanned by smog. A plaque saying, Ministry of State Security, Leipzig Division, or something like it, had hung there. It had been removed in a kind of fearful joy during the revolution and has not been seen since. I walked around inside. All the desks were just as they were left the night the demonstrators took the building. Frighteningly neat. Dial phones sat in breeding pairs. Shredding machines had been thrown out the back after collapsing in the Stasi's final desperate attempt to destroy the most damning files. Above one desk was the 1989 calendar with a picture of a woman naked from the waist up. But mostly, there were just communist insignia on the walls. The cells were open, set up as if prepared for more prisoners. Despite the best efforts of Miss December, the building felt damp and bureaucratic. The Citizens' Committee administering the museum had mounted displays on cheap particle board screens, there was a print of the famous photograph from the autumn 1989 demonstrations. It showed a sea of people holding candles, their necks craned up to the building, staring their controllers in the face. They knew it was from here that their lives were observed, manipulated, and sometimes ruined. There were copies of the increasingly frantic telexes from the Berlin headquarters of the Stasi to here, where the officers had barricaded themselves in with tin on the windows. "Secure all ministry premises," they read, "and protect all covert objects." My favourites were the pictures of protesters occupying the building on the 4th of December 1989, squatting in the corridors with the surprise still on their faces, as if half expecting to be asked to leave. As they entered the building, the Stasi guards had to ask to see the demonstrators' identity cards, in a strange parody of the control they were, at that very moment, losing. The demonstrators, in shock, obediently pulled their cards from their wallets. Then they seized the building. Large and small mysteries were accounted for when the files were opened. Not least, perhaps, the tics of the ordinary man in the street. This document was on display. Signals for observation. 1. Watch out. Subject is coming. Touch nose with hand or handkerchief. 2. Subject is moving on, going further or overtaking. Stroke hair with hand or raise hat briefly. 3. Subject standing still. Lay one hand against back or on the stomach. 4. Observing agent wishes to terminate observation because cover is threatened. Bend and retie shoelaces. 5. Subject returning. Both hands against back or on stomach. 6. Observing agent wishes to speak with team leader or other observing agents. Take out briefcase or equivalent and examine contents. I pictured the street ballet of the deaf and dumb. Agents signalling to each other from corner to corner, stroking noses, tummies, backs and hair, tying and untying shoelaces, lifting their hats to strangers and rifling through papers, a choreography for very nasty scouts. Towards the back of the building, three rooms housed Stasi artefacts in glass cases. There was a box of fake wigs and moustaches, alongside small tubes of glue to affix them. There were women's vinyl handbags with built-in microphones disguised as flower petals in a studded decoration. There were bugs that had been implanted in apartment walls and a pile of mail that never reached the West. One of the envelopes had a child's handwriting on it in coloured pencil, a different colour for each letter of the address. One glass case contained nothing but empty jars. I was staring at it when a woman approached me. She looked like a female version of Luther, except she was beautiful. She was 50-ish, with high cheekbones and a direct gaze. She looked friendly, but she also looked as if she knew I had been making mental ridicule of a regime which required its members to sign pledges of allegiance that looked like marriage certificates, confiscated children's birthday cards to their grandparents, and typed up inane protocols at desks beneath calendars of large-breasted women. This was Frau Hollitzer, who runs the museum. Frau Hollitzer explained to me that the jars in front of us were smell samples. The Stasi had developed a quasi-scientific method, smell sampling, as a way to find criminals. The theory was that we all have our own identifying odour, which we leave on everything we touch. These smells can be captured and, with the help of trained sniffer dogs, compared to find a match. The Stasi would take its dogs and jars to a location where they suspected an illegal meeting had occurred and see if the dogs could pick up the scents of the people whose essences were captured in the jars. Mostly, smell samples were collected surreptitiously. The Stasi might break into someone's apartment and take a piece of clothing worn close to the skin, often underwear. Alternatively, a suspect would be brought in under some pretext for questioning, and the vinyl seat he or she had sat on would be wiped afterward with a cloth. The pieces of stolen clothing, or the cloth, would then be placed in a sealed jar. The containers looked like jam bottling jars. A label read, Name, Hair, Name, Time, 1 hour. Object, Worker's underpants. When the citizens of Leipzig entered this building, they found a large collection of smell samples. Then the jars disappeared. It was not until June 1990 that they turned up, in the smell pantry of the Leipzig police. But they were empty. Apparently, the Leipzig police had taken them for their own use, even in the period after the fall of the wall, when democracy was beginning here. The jars still bore all their meticulous labels. From these it was clear that the Leipzig Stasi had collected smell samples of the entire political opposition in this part of Saxony. No one knows who has these scraps of material and old socks now, nor what they might be keeping them for. Later, Frau Hollitzer told me about Miriam, a young woman whose husband had died in a Stasi remand cell nearby. It was rumored the Stasi orchestrated the funeral, to the point of substituting an empty coffin for a full one, and cremating the body to destroy any evidence of the cause of death. I imagine paid-off pallbearers pretending to struggle under the weight of an empty coffin, or perhaps genuinely struggling beneath a coffin filled with 80 kilos of old newspapers and stones. I imagine not knowing whether your husband hanged himself, or whether someone you now pass in the street killed him. I thought I would like to speak with Miriam before my imaginings set like false memories. I went home to Australia, but now I am back in Berlin. I could not get Miriam's story, the strange second-hand tale of a woman I had never met, out of my mind. I found a part-time job in television and set about looking for some of the stories from this land gone wrong. Chapter 2. Miriam. I work at the Overseas Television Service in what was West Berlin. The service was set up by the government after the war to beam benign Germanness around the globe. My job is to answer letters from viewers who've been beamed at and have some queries. At viewer post, I'm a cross between an agony aunt, a free research assistant, and a receptacle for messages in bottles. Dear viewer post, I am looking for the address of the clinic of Dr. Manfred von Arden to try his new ultra-high-temperature cancer treatment for advanced stages, as featured in your program. Dear viewer post, many thanks for your interesting program on asylum seekers in your country. I am 16 years old and living in Accra. Could you please send me informations on asylum? The occasional neo-Nazi from Missouri or Liverpool writes, wanting information on mother groups in East Germany. A man from Birmingham, Alabama, sent me a photograph of himself in uniform at the liberation of Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in 1945, standing behind corpses. He wrote, Thank you for your program on the 50th anniversary of the peace. I would like you to know that I recall with great fondness the welcome we Americans received from the ordinary German people. In the villages they had nothing, but when we came, they shared it with us like family. I write contained and appropriate responses. Sometimes I wonder what it would be like to be German. Alexander Scheller is my boss. He's a tall man, just on 40, who has a picture of a tight-faced blonde wife, a glass ashtray, and a permanent cup of coffee on his vast and otherwise empty desk. He taps incessantly, fidgety with caffeine and nicotine. To his credit, he does me the honor of behaving as if my work answering viewer correspondence is as important as that of the journalists and professional people here. A month ago, I sat on the other side of that desk, because he had made time for a meeting I called myself. Scheller's offsider, Uwe Schmidt, was there too. Uwe's main job as adjutant is to make Scheller seem important enough to have an adjutant. The other part of his job is to appear busy and time short, which is more difficult because he has hardly anything to do. Scheller and Uwe are both Westerners. Uwe has a similar amount of TV journo energy to Scheller, only Uwe's is sexual, not chemical. Uwe's girlfriends are always leaving him, and he is therefore, at most times of the day, and in almost any company, deeply distracted by desire. I like Uwe, and feel sorry for him because I know that in looking for the reason why his girlfriends leave him, he has started to wear himself out from the inside. I recently saw him singing, "You're once, twice, three times a lady," in English in his car at the lights, with tears on his face. Now, over the other side of the desk, he caught himself looking at me like food, and I knew he hadn't heard what I was saying. "Pardon?" he said. I decided to start from the beginning. "We've had a letter from a German living in Argentina in response to the item on the puzzle women."
"Puzzle women?"
"Puzzle women," Uwe said, trying to remember the story. "They sit in Nuremberg puzzling together the shredded files the Stasi couldn't burn or pulp."
"Right, I'm with you,"
Scheller said. He was tapping the eraser end of a pencil on the desk. "This man says he left Dresden after the war. He asks whether we might do an item on what things are actually like now for the East German people, instead, as he says, of always broadcasting what is being done for the poor cousins."
"Puzzle women," Uwe muttered.
I took a deep breath. "And I agree with him. We're always talking about the things that Germany is doing for people in the former GDR. It would be great to do an item from the Eastern point of view. For instance, to find out what it's like to wait for part of your file to be pieced together."
"You know, we don't broadcast domestically," Scheller said, "so there's no point us doing items on the Ossis for their gratification."
I looked to Uwe, off to one side with his feet up on Scheller's acreage of desk. He was rolling a fountain pen over his knuckles, lost in a reverie, puzzling over women.
I know," I said to Scheller. "But East Germany, I just think we should know some of the stories from there. From here, I mean."
"What sort of stories?"
Scheller asked. Behind him, the computer gave off a Glockenspiel beep, signalling new email.
"I don't know," I said, because I really didn't know. "There must be people who stood up to the regime somehow, or who were wrongfully imprisoned." I felt myself warming up, a little dangerous. "I mean, after World War II, people searched high and low for the smallest signs of resistance to Hitler, as if a tiny piece of national pride could be salvaged and tied onto a couple of student pacifists and a bunch of old Prussian aristocrats. What about here? There must have been some resistance to the dictatorship."
"They aren't a nation."
Scheller was tetchy now.
"I know, but it was a nation."
"Look," he said, "they are just Germans who had communism for 40 years and went backwards. And all they want now is the money to have big TV sets and holidays in Mallorca like everyone else. It was an experiment, and it failed."
"Well, what do you suggest I write to this guy?"
I could hear my voice getting higher.
"Should I tell him that no one here is interested in East Germans and their stories because they don't form part of our overseas image?"
"Oh, for God's sake," Scheller said. "You won't find the great story of human courage you are looking for. It would have come out years ago, straight after 1989. They are just a bunch of downtrodden whingers, with a couple of mild-mannered civil rights activists among them, and only a couple at that. They just had the rotten luck to end up behind the Iron Curtain."
He tilted his head.
"What has gotten into you?"
Uwe put his feet down.
"Are you all right?"
Uwe walked back to my desk with me, solicitous as a doctor with a patient who's had bad news. That he did this made me realize I'd gone over the top. He said,
"He's simply not interested."
"No one is interested in these people."
"Look."
Uwe touched my forearm gently, turning me towards him like a dance partner. His eyes were green and slanted up, his teeth short and neat, little pearls.
"You're probably right. No one here is interested. They were backward and they were broke.
and the whole Stasi thing. He trailed off. His breath was minty. It's sort of embarrassing.
I replied to the Argentinian, thanking him for his suggestion, but telling him that, regrettably, the station's remit is only for current affairs and news, and we are therefore unable to investigate more personal point-of-view stories. A week ago he wrote back. He was angry, telling me that history is made of personal stories. He said that issues were being swept under the carpet in East Germany, and people along with them. It took 20 years after the war, he said, for the Nazi regime even to begin to be discussed in Germany, and that that process is repeating itself now. Will it be 2010 or 2020 before what happened there is remembered, he wrote. And why are some things easier to remember the more time has passed since they occurred? The woman opposite me wakes up as the train pulls into Leipzig. Because there is something intimate about watching another person sleep, she now acknowledges my existence. Wiedersehen, she says, as she leaves the compartment. Miriam Weber stands at the end of the platform, a small, still woman in the stream of alighting passengers. She holds a single rose in front of her body, so I will know who she is. We shake hands, not looking too closely at first, talking about trains, trips, rain. It feels like a blind date, because we have described ourselves to each other. I know she has not told her story to a stranger before. We drive through Leipzig. The city has been transformed into a building site, a work in progress with some new goal. Cranes are picking over holes open as wounds. People ignore them, weaving head down along footpaths and alleyways. On one of the concrete towers a large Mercedes emblem rotates, waltzing to the new tune here. Miriam's apartment is in the roof of her building. There are 5 flights of stairs, broad, sweeping stairs with a graceful dark balustrade. I try not to puff too loudly. I try not to think about my damaged head. I try to remember when elevators were invented. When we reach it, the apartment is one big light space under the eaves, full of plants and lamps, with views over all of Leipzig. From here you could see anyone coming. We sit in large cane chairs. Miriam, when I look at her straight, is a woman in her mid-40s, with a cute short haircut, the bits on the crown sticking out like a cartoon boy, and small round glasses. She wears a long black sweater and pants and curls her legs under her. She has a surprisingly big nicotine-stained voice. She is so slight that the voice comes from nowhere and everywhere at once. It is not immediately evident that it is hers. It fills the room and it wraps us up.
I became officially an enemy of the state at 16. At 16!
Miriam looks at me through her glasses, and her eyes are wide and blue. In her voice is a combination of pride in how she became such a fiend, and disbelief that this country created enemies of its own children.
You know, at 16, you have this sort of itch.
In 1968, the old university church in Leipzig was demolished suddenly, without any public consultation. 250 kilometres away, the Prague Spring was in full swing, and the Russians had not yet brought the tanks into the streets to crush the demonstrators for democracy. The demolition of the church in Leipzig provided a focus for the expression of a widespread malaise the Leipzigers had caught from their Czech cousins. 23 years after the end of World War II, the next generation was asking questions about the way their parents had implemented communist ideals. The Leipzig demonstrations were interpreted by the East German regime as a sign of the times, a cinder likely to ignite. The police doused people with fire hoses and made many arrests. Miriam and her friend Ursula thought this was not right.
At 16, you have an idea of justice, and we just thought it was wrong. We weren't seriously against the state. We hadn't given it that much thought. We just thought it wasn't fair to rough people up and bring in horses and so on.
The two of them decided to do something about it. At a stationer's, they bought a child stamp set with ink, small rubber letters, and a rail to put them in.
You could buy that sort of thing? I ask.
I know that Ronio printers, typewriters, and later photocopiers were strictly, if not particularly effectively, controlled by license in the GDR.
Not after what we did, she smiles. The Stasi had them taken off the shelves.
Miriam and Ursula made leaflets.
Consultation, not water cannon. And people of the People's Republic, speak up.
They stuck them up around town one night. The girls wore gloves so as not to leave fingerprints.
We had read as many novels as the next person, she says, laughing.
Miriam had the posters tucked in her jacket. Ursula had a tub of paste and a brush hidden in a milk crate. They were clever. They slapped the leaflets up in telephone booths over the instructions and at tram stops over the timetables.
We wanted to make sure people read them.
They made a circle around the town, and then they went straight through it. The girls passed the Communist Party regional headquarters. Things were going well.
We just looked at each other, and we couldn't resist.
They marched in and told the guard on duty they were there to see Herr Schmidt, on the off chance that someone by that name was in the building. They didn't stop to think what they would have done had a Herr Schmidt come out. The guard made a call. He put the phone down.
No, Comrade Schmidt's not here at the moment.
The girls said they would come back the next day.
On the way out, there were these beautiful, smooth columns.
Miriam is convinced, however, that had they left it at that, they would have gotten away with it. But on the home stretch, they went one step too far. Passing a building where some of their classmates lived, they put leaflets in the letterboxes of two boys they knew. The next day, one of the parents rang the police.
Why would you call the police about some junk mail? I ask.
Because they were silly, or maybe they were in the party. Who knows?
It seems so harmless, I say.
Miriam comes back quiet but strong.
At that time, it was not harmless. It was the crime of sedition.
In East Germany, information ran in a closed circuit between the government and its press outlets. As the government controlled the newspapers, magazines, and television, training as a journalist was effectively training as a government spokesperson. Access to books was restricted. Censorship was a constant pressure on writers and a given for readers who learnt to read between the lines. The only mass medium the government couldn't control was the signal from Western television stations, but it tried. Until the early 1970s, the Stasi used to monitor the angle of people's antennae hanging out of their apartments, punishing them if they were turned to the West. Later, they gave up. The benefits of soporific commercial programming apparently outweighed the dangers of news bulletins from the free world. Sedition was handled by the secret police, not the ordinary Volkspolizei. The Stasi were methodical. They questioned all the classmates of the boys who had received the pamphlets. They talked to the principal, teachers, parents. Several days went by. Miriam and Ursula agreed on an arrest and incarceration plan. Neither would admit anything. The Stasi arrived at a short list of suspects. Men with gloves and dogs combed Miriam's house.
And we thought we'd been so careful, thrown everything out and destroyed all the evidence.
The Stasi found some of the little rubber letters in the carpet. Miriam's parents told the officers they did not know how such a thing could have happened in their house. Both girls were placed in solitary confinement for a month. They had no visits from their parents or from lawyers, no books, no newspapers, not a phone call. In the beginning, they stuck to their plan.
No, sir, I don't know either how the leaflets got there. No, it couldn't possibly have been her.
But eventually, Miriam says, they break you, just like fiction. They used the old trick and told each of us that the other had admitted, so we might as well too. After no visits, no books, nothing, you think, well, she probably did say it.
The girls were let out to await their trials. When she got home, Miriam thought, there's no way they're going to put me back in that place. The next morning, she got on a train for Berlin. It was New Year's Eve, 1968, and Miriam Weber was going over the wall. Chapter 3. Bornholmer Bridge. It takes less than 2 hours to get from Leipzig to Berlin, but Miriam had never been there in her life. Alone in the big city, she bought herself a map at the station.
I wanted to have a look at the border in a few places. I thought, this cannot be for real. Somewhere or other, you just must be able to get over that thing.
At the Brandenburg Gate, she was amazed that she could walk right up to the wall. She couldn't believe the guards let her get that close. But it was too flat and too high to climb. Later, she found out that the whole border paraphernalia only started behind the wall at that spot.
Even if I had been able to get up there, I could only have put my head over and waved, "Hello!" to the Eastern guards.
She waves with both hands and shrugs her shoulders. By nightfall, the chances were looking slim.
I hadn't found any holes in it, Miriam says.
She was cold and unhappy. She sat in the suburban train on her way to Alexanderplatz station to catch the regional line home. It was dark, and she was going back to prison. The train sluiced between buildings, high up on its stilts. Buildings on both sides, flat concrete render facades with rectangular windows 5 stories high. Some lit, some dark, some with plants, some without. Then the vista changed. It took Miriam a moment to notice it in the dark, but suddenly she was going past high wire mesh fencing.
I thought, if I'm travelling along here and there's this big wire fence right next to me, then West Berlin would have to be just over there on the other side.
She got off the train, crossed the platform and caught another train back. It was as she had thought, a tall wire fence. She got off again and went back, this time getting out at Bornholmer Bridge station. Later, I looked up the Bornholmer Bridge on a street map. I had heard of it, and thought it might have been one of the places East and West Germany used to exchange each other's spies. Now I see nothing but this bridge each time I open a street map. It is like once you notice someone has a cast in his eye, that's all you can see in his face. A Western train line and an Eastern train line met rarely in divided Germany. At Bornholmer Bridge, the Western train line still swoops down from the northwest to the southwest, and the eastern one up from the southeast to the northeast. The shapes they make on the map are like figures in profile doing a Maori nose kiss. At Bornholmer Bridge, the border ran, in theory, along the space between the tracks. In other places in Berlin, the border, and with it the wall, cut a strange wound through the city. The wall went through houses, along streets, along waterways, and sliced underground train lines to pieces. Here, instead of cutting the train line, the East Germans built most of the wall's fortifications in front of the train line on the eastern side, letting the eastern trains run through to the furthest wall at the end of the death strip.
I had a look at the lie of the land and decided, not too bad.
Miriam could see the border installation, the cacophony of wire and cement, asphalt and sand. In front of where it began was a hectare or so of fenced-in garden plots, each with its own little shed. These handkerchief gardens are a traditional German solution to apartment dwellers yearning for a tool shed and a vegetable garden. They make a patchwork of green in odd corners of urban land, along train lines or canals or, as here, in the lee of the wall.
Miriam climbed through and over the fences separating the gardens, trying to get closer to the wall. It was dark, and I was lucky. Later I learned that they usually patrolled the gardens as well. She got as far as she could go, but not to the wall, because there was this great fat hedge growing in front of it. She rummaged around in someone's tool shed for a ladder and found one. She put it against the hedge and climbed up. She took a good long look around. The whole strip was lit by a row of huge street lamps on poles, their heads bent in submission at exactly the same angle. Overhead, fireworks had started to fizz and pop for the new year. The Bornholmer Bridge was about 150 meters away. Between her and the west, there was a wire mesh fence, a patrol strip, a barbed wire fence, a 20-meter-wide asphalt street for the personnel carriers, and a footpath. Then the eastern sentry huts stretched out about 100 meters apart, and behind them, more barbed wire. Miriam takes a piece of paper and draws me a mess of lines so I can see it too. Beyond all of that, I could see the wall I had seen from inside the train, the wall that runs along the train line. I assumed that there, behind it, was the west, and I was right. I could have been wrong, but I was right. If she had any future, it was over there, and she needed to get to it. I sit in the chair exploring the meaning of dumbstruck, rolling the word around in my mind. I laugh with Miriam as she laughs at herself and at the boldness of being 16. At 16, you are invulnerable. I laugh with her about rummaging around for a ladder in other people's sheds, and I laugh harder when she finds one. We laugh at the improbability of it, of someone barely more than a child poking about in Beatrix Potter's garden by the wall, watching out for Mr. McGregor and his blunderbuss, and looking for a stepladder to scale one of the most fortified borders on earth. We both like the girl she was, and I like the woman she has become. She says suddenly, "I still have the scars on my hands from climbing the barbed wire, but you can't see them so well now." She holds out her hands. The soft parts of her palms are crazed with definite white scars, each about a centimeter long. The first fence was wire mesh with a roll of barbed wire along the top. The strange thing is, you know how the barbed wire used to be looped in a sort of tube along the top of the fence? My pants were all ripped up and I got caught, stuck on the roll. I just hung there. I cannot believe no one saw me. A Pierrot doll hanging on display. Miriam must have come unstuck, because next she got down on all fours and started her way across the path, across the wide street, and across the next strip. The whole area was lit as bright as day. I just got down on my knees and went for it, but I was careful. I was very slow. After the footpath, she crossed the wide asphalt road. She could not feel her body. She was invisible. She was nothing but nerve endings and fear. Why didn't they come for her? What were they doing? She reached the end of the asphalt, and they still hadn't come. There was a cable suspended about a meter off the ground. She stopped. I had seen it from my ladder. I thought it might be some sort of alarm or something, so I went down flat on my belly underneath. She crawled across the last stretch to a kink in the wall, and crouched and looked and did not breathe. I stayed there. I was waiting to see what would happen. I just stared. She thought her eyes would come loose from her skull. Where were they? Something shifted right near her leg. It was a dog. A huge German shepherd pointed himself in her direction. That cable was no alarm. It had dogs chained to it. She could not move. The dog did not move. She thought the guard's eyes would follow the pointing dog to her. She waited for him to bark. If she moved away along the wall, he would go for her. I don't know why it didn't attack me. I don't know how dogs see. But maybe it had been trained to attack moving targets, people running across, and I'd gone on all fours. Maybe it thought I was another dog. They held each other's gaze for what seemed a long time. Then a train went by, and, unusually, it was a steam train. The two of them were covered in a fine mist. Perhaps then he lost my scent? Eventually, the dog walked away. Miriam waited another long time. I thought he would come back for me, but he didn't. She climbed the last barbed wire fence to reach the top of the wall bordering the train line. She could see the west, shiny cars and lit streets, and the Springer Press building. She could even see the Western Guards sitting at their sentry posts. The wall was broad. She had about 4 meters to cross on top of it, and then a little railing to get under. That was all there was. She couldn't believe it. She wanted to run the last few steps before they caught her. The railing was really only so high, she says, putting an arm out to thigh height. All I had to do was get under it. I'd been so very careful and so very slow. Now I thought, you have only 4 more steps. Just run before they get you. But here... She marks an X over and over on the map she has drawn me. Here was a tripwire. The voice is very soft. She marks and remarks the X till I think the paper will tear. I did not see the wire. Sirens went off, wailing. The Western sentry hut shone searchlights to find her and to prevent the Easterners from shooting her. The Eastern guards took her away quickly. "You piece of shit," a young one said. They took her to the Berlin Stasi HQ. They bandaged her hands and legs, and that was the first time she noticed her blood or felt any pain. The blood was on her face and in her hair. But they really hadn't seen me. No one had even seen me. She came so close. In the west, the neon shone and overhead fireworks destroyed themselves in the air. Miriam was returned to Leipzig in the back of a paddy wagon. The Stasi officer questioning her told her they had contacted her parents, who no longer wanted anything to do with her. Did you believe him?
Well, no. Not really, no.
It was very hard to be sure of anything, of anyone. Miriam pauses. It was an uncomfortable question.
I think they probably demoted that dog, poor thing, she says. Either that or shot him.
Miriam was held in a cell in Dimitrovstrasse, which has been recreated in the nearby Stasi Museum. The cell is 2 meters by 3, and at one end there is a tiny window of dull, frosted glass, recessed very high up. It has a bench with a mattress, a toilet and a sink. The door is thick, with metal bolts across it, and a spy hole for the guard to watch you. It is hung in a wall so deep, I felt I was going into an airlock. Again, Miriam was allowed no telephone calls, no lawyer, no contact with the outside world. She was 16 and back in solitary.
When they came to take me to interrogation, she says, smiling, at least it was something to do. But that, she pauses, that is when the whole miserable story really took off.
Back in Leipzig, the Stasi let her have it. During the Korean War in the 1950s, myths circulated of obscene torture methods practiced on American POWs. After they were captured, the men would be taken to a camp, reappearing as little as a week later on a platform, mindlessly mouthing their conversion to communism for the cameras. After the war, it was revealed that, contrary to rumor, the Korean military secret was neither traditional nor high-tech. It was sleep deprivation. A hungry man can still spit bile, but a zombie is remarkably pliable. The interrogation of Miriam Weber, aged 16, took place every night for 10 nights for the 6 hours between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. Lights went out in the cell at 8 p.m., and she slept for 2 hours before being taken to the interrogation room. She was returned to her cell for 2 hours before the lights went on again at 6 a.m. She was not permitted to sleep during the day. A guard watched through the peephole and banged on the door if she nodded off. Once in a while, I'd look at the eye in the peephole as he was hitting the door, and I'd think, why don't you just piss off for a change, and keep dozing? Then he'd come in, shake me, and take the mattress off the bench so there'd be nothing left to sit on. They really made sure that I didn't sleep. I cannot explain how kaput it makes you. Afterwards, I looked it up. Sleep deprivation can mimic the symptoms of starvation, particularly in children. Victims become disorientated and cold. They lose their sense of time, becoming locked in an interminable present. Sleep deprivation also causes a number of neurological dysfunctions, which become more extreme the longer it continues. In the end, your waking hours take on the logic of a dream, where odd things are connected, and you are just angry, angry, angry with the world that will not let you rest. For the Stasi, it was beyond comprehension that a 16-year-old with no tools, no training, and no help could crawl across their anti-fascist protective measure on her hands and knees. Involuntarily revealing his admiration, the guard who first took her to the interrogation room wanted to know what sports clubs she was in. She wasn't in any. But the main point of the questioning, night after night, was to extract the name of the underground escape organization that had helped her. They wanted the names of members, physical descriptions. Whose scheme was it to go on New Year's Eve when the night was full of noise? How did she know to go to the Bonhomer Garden plots if she had never been to Berlin before? Who had taught her to climb barbed wire? And most insistently, who told her how to get past the dogs? They just could not fathom how I'd got past that dog, she says. Oh, poor dog. They were not above spite. Miriam was told that even if she had made it over, she would have been sent back because she was underage. She protested. There's no way the Westerners would have sent me back here, she told the interrogating officers. Because I am a refugee from political persecution by you people, which all started when I put up leaflets. Miriam puts her chin out, imitating the cheeky kid who still thinks there is a safety net to catch her. There was one main interrogator, Major Fleischer, but sometimes there were two of them. They both had moustaches and bristly short haircuts, grey uniforms done up tight. The younger one was so stiff he could have had a baking tray stuffed down his coat. Major Fleischer had hair in his ears. Sometimes he pretended to be her friend, like a good uncle. Other times he was threatening. There are other ways we could do this, you know. Her answers remained the same. I got a train from Leipzig. I bought a map at the station. I climbed over with a ladder. I went under on my belly, and then I made a run for it. 10 times 24 hours in which you hardly sleep. 10 times 24 hours in which you are hardly awake. 10 days is time enough to die, to be born, to fall in love, and to go mad. 10 days is a very long time. Question. What does the human spirit do after 10 days without sleep, and 10 days of isolation tempered only by nocturnal threat sessions? Answer. It dreams up a solution. On the 11th night, Miriam gave them what they wanted.
I thought,
You people want an underground escape organization? Well, I'll give you one then.
Fleischer had won.
There then, he said. That wasn't so bad now, was it? Why didn't you tell us earlier and save yourself all this trouble?
They let her sleep for a fortnight and gave her one book each week. She read it in a day, then started memorizing the pages, walking up and down in the cell with the book to her chest.
In retrospect, it's funny, Miriam says, but at the time it was pure unalloyed frustration. I cooked them up a story I would not have believed myself, even then. It was utterly absurd, but they were so wild about getting an escape organization that they swallowed it. All I wanted to do was sleep.
Auerbach Cellar is a famous Leipzig institution. It is an underground bar and restaurant with oak bench tables in long alcoves under a curved roof, just like a cellar. The walls and ceilings are covered with dark painted scenes from Goethe's Faust. Faust meeting Mephistopheles. Faust betraying Margarita. Faust in despair. Goethe used to drink here. It is a good place to meet the devil. This is the story Miriam told the Stasi. It all began when she was going to meet a friend in Auerbach's cellar to eat goosefat rolls. Her friend did not appear, so she sat down at one of the long tables by herself and started in on the food. The place was full. It was nearly Christmas. Four men came and asked if they could share the table. They sat down to eat. Miriam listened to them talk. One of them had a Berlin accent in which gut is jut and ich is icke. Miriam is enjoying herself at this point. She looks at me and her face is bright. She is imagining herself at 16 and it makes her happy.
So I said to the man, the one who looked like the leader, "Are you from Berlin?" And he said, "Yes." "How is it going in Berlin then?" I said.
Miriam's eyes widen and she looks like a cartoon boy again.
"Fine, thanks." "Where do you live in Berlin then?"
"Pankow."
Is that near the wall?" "Actually, it is. You're not thinking of making a run for it, are you?"
"Yes, I am."
"Well, you can't just front up to the wall and expect to find a spot to climb over. Come with me and I'll give you a tip."
Miriam said, "Okay." So the five of them left and jumped in a cab. They travelled in a southerly direction, but she wasn't sure where because it was already dark. They went to an apartment on the second, or was it the third story of a building? Hard to remember exactly. There was no nameplate on the door, so unfortunately she couldn't say whose place it was. The man and his accomplices produced a map of Berlin and showed her the spot to get over. Then they called another taxi, dropped her back to Auerbach Cellar, and she caught the tram home. Miriam is laughing. She looks at me as if to say,
"Have you ever in your life heard such a ridiculous story? Can you believe they swallowed that?"
I look back, confused. I try to rearrange my face. What is so improbable about someone offering handy hints on wall jumping? I feel I'm about to have something basic explained to me. My head is cocked like a dog watching TV. It can't make out what's happening, but it sure is interesting. Miriam explains gently that in the GDR, it was inconceivable that a person would ask a stranger, a total stranger, whether they lived near the border. It was also inconceivable that the stranger would ask you whether you were thinking of escaping. And it was more inconceivable still that they would then proffer handy escape tips on the spot. Relations between people were conditioned by the fact that one or other of you could be one of them. Everyone suspected everyone else, and the mistrust this bred was the foundation of social existence. Miriam could have been denounced by the man for having asked a question about the border and admitting she was thinking of going over, and she could have denounced him in turn for offering to show her how. Underground escape organizations existed in the GDR, but you needed an intermediary to communicate with them. It would never happen so blithely over goose-fat rolls and beer. Fleischer wanted a name.
"That I couldn't tell you," she told him. "I didn't hear them call each other by any name."
"What did he look like? The leader?"
"Well," she said, "he was about so tall," she puts her hand in the air above her head, "and strong-looking, well-built, you know."
She is smiling, enjoying her fantasy of a man.
"I told him that he was totally bald. Oh, and he had remarkably small feet."
I'm laughing hard now, enjoying the child's eye detail.
"Yep, there you have it. It was pretty much the chrome dome with the remarkably small feet. What's more, I told Fleischer I had the impression he was a regular at our Bach cellar."
She laughs too, pulling on a cigarette as she adjusts herself in her chair. Miriam had thought it all through. No matter how many small-footed, bald men they found for a lineup, she would fail to recognize any of them. 2 weeks passed before her next interrogation. She was summoned to Fleischer not at 10 p.m., but in the afternoon. He had both hands on the table as if restraining himself from throwing it.
"My people," he bellowed, "have gone and got themselves a case of frostbite on your account. How dare you tell such tales? What could have possessed you to make up such a story?"
"I wanted to sleep."
Fleischer said her conduct amounted to deception of the ministry, which was a criminal offence. She would now be up for an even longer sentence. And it was going to be bad enough for her, considering she could have started a war. Miriam thought he must be crazy. Had she jumped over the last railing, he continued, the East German soldiers would have shot at her from behind, and the West Germans would have shot back. She could have been responsible for the outbreak of civil war. Then he softened.
"But for your sake, I will take this little episode out of your file. Never let it be said we didn't give you a fair go."
Later, it was clear to Miriam that he had been protecting himself. Had she been asked in court why she invented such a story, she would simply have said, "Because they wouldn't let me sleep." Apparently, even in the GDR, sleep deprivation amounted to torture. And torture, at least of minors, was not official policy. As it was, the judge gave her 1.5 years in Stauberg, the women's prison at Hoheneck. And at the end of the 3-day trial, he said to her, "Juvenile accused number 725, you realize that your activities could have started World War III. They were all crazy, and they were locking her up. Chapter 4. Charlie.
"When I got out of prison, I was basically no longer human," Miriam says.
On the first day at Hoheneck, Miriam was required to undress, leave the clothes she came in, and take in her hands the blue and yellow striped uniform. She was led naked down a corridor into a room with a deep-tiled tub in it. 2 female guards were waiting. This was the baptism of welcome. It was the only time she ever thought she would die. The bath was filled with cold water. One guard held her feet and the other her hair. They pushed her head under for a long time, then dragged her up by the hair, screaming at her. They held her down again. She could do nothing, and she could not breathe. And up.
"You piece of filth, you little upstart, you stupid traitor, you little bitch!"
And under. When she came up, the insults were what she breathed. She thought they would kill her. Miriam is upset. Her voice is stretched, and I can't look at her. Perhaps they beat something out of her she didn't get back.
Miriam says the prisoners were brutal to each other, too. She says the criminal prisoners received privileges for abusing the politicals. She says that for 18 months she was addressed by number and never by name. She says that there was a hoard and barter system, in fact a whole economy in sanitary napkins. I can't stay focused on the awfulness of it all, and my mind wanders disobediently to sitcoms. I think of the old TV series Prisoner, set in a women's prison, clanging metal gates before each ad break, and a kindly lesbian in the laundry, steaming away. But Miriam has found her stride again. She tells me at Hoheneck the prisoners worked in a sweatshop making sheets. An ordinary day started at 4:30 a.m. with an alarm. When the warden's key rattled in the door, all the prisoners stood to attention against the wall. This was roll call by number. They were counted as well. They went to breakfast and then to the workroom where they were counted again. To make sure no one had run off between the cell and the canteen. If Miriam wanted to go to the toilet, she stood to